power. I mean, we've seen some awesome pictures of it this year, haven't we? Earthquakes and tsunamis. If I was Mark Mennell on the screens now, we'd be coming some of those pictures of that Japanese tsunami and the waves simply sweeping everything in front of it. Devastating, terrifying. And this past week has provided another extraordinary example of irresistible surge and power, this time not of nature, but public opinion. The forces that rose up in the light of the phone hacking of Millie Dowler and others coming to light, especially once they reached the internet and started going viral, have proved uncontrollable. Politicians have had to bow to them and change their minds about inquiries. Well, that's happened often enough before, but PR companies, the media itself, haven't been able to manage them. Even the Murdoch Empire couldn't handle it. And Britain's biggest selling newspaper, The News of the World, closed within days. Extraordinary, isn't it? Many think, of course, that some of the innocent have got punished because none of the current journalists are suspected of any of these malpractices, and some guilty executives we suspect are still in place. But actually, with this kind of power, that's the sort of justice it hands out, rough justice. It doesn't really do nuances. Well, the power of public opinion is on display in this chapter, this incident we're looking at tonight. The ugly side of it. A mob aroused by self-interest, thinly disguised in a cloak of religious moral high ground, frightening in its intensity, unpredictable in what it'll do next. If you've ever been caught up in a crowd, a mob that's gone violent, you'll know the proper terror that seizes almost anyone who's caught on the fringes of it. Ephesus was the home to the temple of Artemis, Diana, not just any old temple. This isn't, you know, another city, another temple, another riot. This temple was one of the seven wonders of the world at the time. And the riot had doubtless been brewing for months. Whenever they have the inquiry afterwards, you discover the seeds of it are way back. But it still needed a spark to set it off. And the spark seems to have come from what today would have been a report by Robert Peston, the BBC business editor, who would have leaked some economic data in his piece showing manufacturing output downturn. And Demetrius, the shop steward of the Silversmiths Union, calls a meeting, and he obviously knows just how to press all the right buttons. He fans them into a frightening mob as he blames the loss of trade, you noticed in verse 26, on this fellow Paul and his insistence that man-made gods are no gods at all. It quickly becomes an appeal to local patriotism. Ephesus is an Artemis city, much the way these days we often say, you know, Britain's a Christian country. The good name of Artemis needs defending. And as the mood turns ugly and the mob sweeps along the streets past any police lines, if they had any such things in those days, and into the open-air theater, it turns from a demo into the rowdiest of town hall meetings. Frightening, loud, angry, irrational. They were furious, verse 28. Verse 34, they all shouted in unison for about 2 hours, "Great is Diana, great is Artemis of the Ephesians." And the only one who can eventually control the crowd is the city clerk, who finally quietens them down, points out that the Christians haven't broken any of the laws of the land, and the courts are available to Demetrius and his colleagues if they've got any genuine evidence of sharp practice, and he even makes it clear that their own behavior won't stand much scrutiny in the law courts before the meeting fizzles out and the crowd drift away. You could dine out on "I was there when," you know, for several years to come, don't you think? I mean, the story is gripping, sweaty, frightening, memorable. But the question that hit me this week as I looked at it again and again is, what's it doing in the Bible? I mean, why does Luke give so much space to an incident that seems to come to nothing? Riots of one sort or another happen on most pages in Acts. I mean, there's been one in chapter 14, chapter 16, chapter 17, chapter 18. So why give us so much detail about this one? Why not just head for Jerusalem and Rome, which is where Paul's going, where the whole book is taking us? What lessons can we draw from this unique one-off incident anyway? Well, here are two reminders. Two reminders of truths that constantly appear page after page in this book. Here's the first one. God's gospel keeps provoking opposition. God's gospel keeps provoking opposition. Now, when I talk about God's gospel, I mean the whole story of what's involved when you get caught up with King Jesus. And the gospel, you see, it won't allow me to keep my head beneath the parapet permanently. The gospel won't stay a private religion. Don't misunderstand me. It must become a personal one. But it's not the kind of faith you have privately without it affecting everything else. The gospel transforms lives. So it's going to transform habits and practices of living that we and those around us have grown used to and comfortable with. Here, it's affected the local economy as purchasing habits changed. Long before the days of Twitter and Facebook, a network began to boycott not a newspaper, but idols, little silver shrines with a statue of the goddess Artemis. And whatever precisely the sales figures were, the impact was significant enough for fear of what might happen to spark a riot. See, live for King Jesus, and it means there are some things we will not do. For those Christians, it was not buy, not support, not sponsor, not worship false gods. And of course, it'll mean that for us today as well as Christians. It's why Christians are so vulnerable in countries with a religious culture. You know, Muslim, Hindu, actually, even where secularism has got a religious fervor or passion, as the last century proved all too clearly. For us today, love for King Jesus will mean there are some things we will not do. We won't support or worship false gods, gods like mammon or sex or self. Man-made gods are no gods at all. Sometimes when we start thinking that way, we all get distracted by pragmatism. You know, what good will that do, people say. But this wasn't a campaign to bring down Artemis. We love campaigns, don't we? Especially campaigns against things. This was a turning to Jesus. A turning to Jesus by a church which 2 or 3 years previously didn't even exist. I mean, if we're going to get into campaigns, I sometimes wonder if we don't underestimate our strength. We haven't become so discouraged by year after year of negative church attendance statistics. We forget what an influence the people of God can still have. But here in Ephesus, this baby church impacted the local economy, the local religion, upset the local establishment. And the gospel's always going to have that awkward edge in communities and cultures which aren't shaped by Christianity or, like ours, are turning their back on that shape. The new atheists see it. Seems to me that's why they're so aggressive towards Christianity, even moderate Christians. The politicians sometimes see it. You know, they do explain from time to time, don't they, that the new equality laws aren't actually equal. They simply rearrange the order of rights and freedoms so that freedom of speech, freedom of expression of faith are moved down the pecking order to prevent them influencing society as much as they might. Christians can sometimes be the slowest to spot it. They can imagine you can have faith, gospel faith in private, and not do God in public, whether that's home or the office or parliament. But as the gospel keeps surfacing in the public square, know, elbowing its way in, putting its hand up to ask the awkward question, or embarrassing everyone with a statement of God's opinion, God's verdict, God's command. You know, man-made gods are no gods at all. It sits uneasily with modern ideas of tolerance. So it's no surprise that God's gospel keeps provoking opposition. You know, one of the least surprising things about this incident is to see gospel ministry sparking opposition. It's been the story repeated time and time again through the book of Acts. There is a myth that we Christians, particularly in the West, often cling to, in spite of the evidence that stares us in the face on almost every page of the Bible, the myth that you can enjoy the gospel and fit in. Hold the gospel without it causing waves and rocking the boat. You don't have to go looking for trouble to discover it, as we're seeing in this country with the string of relatively minor legal cases about everything from wearing crosses to praying with patience. And if that's true for an increasingly secular culture like ours, imagine the situation in religious cultures, like the one in Ephesus, like so many parts of the world today. For you see, Jesus cannot just be fitted into an ever-expanding pantheon of gods. As soon as I preach Jesus is Lord, I raise the question of, where does that leave Artemis? Speak of King Jesus, and I instantly start to set the scene for the inevitable showdown with Queen Diana, Queen Artemis. Now, so many countries with a strong religious culture, especially, but by no means exclusively, Muslim and Hindu, spot this tension immediately. They sometimes shape their society and even their laws to make it illegal. The Christian church in Nepal, for example, is very small but one of the fastest growing. But the Nepali government, which has been in a mess for the last 2 or 3 years, has started to get its act together to produce a new constitution. And on the draft constitution, it's going to make it illegal to convert a person or abet him to change his religion. Article 160 of the proposed code says no one will be allowed to do anything or behave in any way that could cause a person to lose faith in their traditional religion or convert to a different religion. The proposal also prohibits conversion by offering inducement or without inducement and preaching a different religion or faith with any other intent. If it's approved, the law will make proclaiming Christ an offense punishable by a maximum of 5 years for a Nepali, deportation for a foreigner. You can't preach Jesus faithfully. You can't preach the Ten Commandments. You shall not make for yourself an idol, clearly. Man-made gods are no gods at all. You can't do that clearly. Have this Jesus, that teaching embraced, and see no impact on the worship of Artemis or any other god. And so often today, it is tragically the Christians who can be the slowest to see that preaching King Jesus clearly must sooner or later impact those of other faiths. The Church Urban Fund is a great Church of England idea. It has raised a significant fund to help the urban poor. I was talking with a vicar the other day who'd applied a few years back for a grant there, and he met with the lady from the Church Urban Fund, and they talked about the needs in his parish. And just before everything was going to go through smoothly, she just raised one final question. She said, "We do need to be assured you won't proselytize the Muslims in the parish." Now, proselytize tends to be a negative way of saying a smear word for tell Jesus to, share your faith with. My vicar friend said that in response he'd looked astonished and said, "We don't discriminate here." I mean, you don't want me to discriminate, do you? tell everyone else how to find eternal life, but not my Muslim neighbors. And to her great credit, the Church Urban Fund lady gave the grant. But only one of them had seen where the teaching of King Jesus inevitably leads. As Luke includes this story, it's just another way of reminding us about our expectations of the Christian life. Now understand, it took 2 or 3 years of Paul preaching every lunchtime in the hall of Tyrannus before the storm broke and the riot rumbled through the city. Oh, some of you here have probably known trouble within 2 or 3 minutes in the family or at work as your allegiance to King Jesus has become known. Others, well, we may have gone 20 or 30 years following Christ and find it strange to hear a voice raised in opposition. Luke isn't teaching us about the timing of it all. He's just saying don't be surprised when opposition comes. It's what's always happened when the gospel gets out. Opposition's not odd. It's normal. Now, if you do, as Mark was saying earlier, and get a copy of Evangelicals Now and read that interview with Ben Quashie, he's a man who suffered much as a Christian back in his home country in Nigeria. You'll find the last question that gets asked to him is this. Ben, you've visited Britain a number of times. You know the culture is getting more hostile to things Christian. What would you say to us in the UK? And this was his answer. Listen to the Word of God. You must carry the gospel with your whole heart to your children, your relatives, and friends. We must agonize in prayer and share the gospel. Inevitably, whether you do this or not, suffering will come your way. It's better to suffer for the gospel than to suffer for no gospel. Whatever is happening by way of Christian suffering around the world, do not think you will be insulated from it. This is going to come with time. Gospel people will get kicked in the teeth. Because God's gospel keeps provoking opposition, which is why it's worth remembering the second truth, that God's gospel keeps enjoying protection. Now let me explain. It's hard, isn't it, to read this incident and not to see a fierce spiritual battle being fought out in Ephesus, even though God isn't mentioned and no Christian says a word. Did you spot that as it was being read? The evil one has his own champion in Demetrius, of course. Demetrius possibly has a tendency to exaggerate the Christian threat. In verse 27, he says, there's a danger. Our trade will lose its good name. Well, perhaps there's no evidence of recession in Ephesus. But Demetrius quickly moves away from the pure financial self-interest to more spiritual concerns. Look at verse 27. The great goddess will be discredited, robbed of her divine majesty. He certainly stirs the mob. So by verse 29, soon the whole city was in an uproar. And he's clearly short on strategy. Don't you think Luke was chuckling to himself as he wrote verse 32? Look at it. The assembly was in confusion. Some were shouting one thing, some another. Many of the people didn't even know why they were there. Well, it happens like that, doesn't it? The Jews try to get a word in, doubtless to distance themselves from the Christians in case any sweeping new legislation was proposed, but they're simply shouted down. So verse 34, they all shouted in unison for about 2 hours. Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. Now, it's obvious, isn't it? There's no logical, reasoned expose of Christianity here. No analysis to put it beyond the legal pale, outside civilized norms. As one writer wrote, the only thing heathenism can do against Paul is to shout itself hoarse. And at this point, if I was writing the story, certainly if I was making it up, I'd bring the Christian hero to the rostrum, wouldn't you?
I'd solve the problem, I'd win the day with the brilliant, powerful gospel presentation. Now I look in Acts 19 and it just doesn't happen. Paul wants to step up to the plate, but he never makes it there. You see verse 30? Paul wanted to appear before the crowd, but the disciples wouldn't let him. And with a half a suspicion that they wouldn't actually have stopped him on their own, Luke goes on, even some of the officials of the province, friends of Paul, but not believers as far as we know, sent him a message begging him not to venture into the theater. I had a missionary friend, he was an eye surgeon working in Central Asia, in one of those countries where the governments tended to frown on Christian missionaries and often revoked their visas. And he won an award in the city for his surgical services, what he'd done for people there. The award would involve a little presentation. He would get the chance to make a little speech afterwards. And there would be all kinds of dignitaries, you know, the medical hierarchy, the civic dignitaries, the secret police, they would all be there. And one of the officials who was briefing him on what would happen said to him at the end of his briefing, he said, "We know why you're here. Now is not the time to tell us." It was meant as a genuinely friendly warning. You suspect these officials say something like this to Paul here, don't they? Now is not the time, Paul. And the apostle stays mute on the sidelines while the battle rages. God will keep his gospel without his apostle. Actually, without having a single player on the pitch. The city clerk, he isn't even a believer. If anything, he has the opposite tendency to Demetrius. He tends to underestimate Christianity. Look at verse 35. "Men of Ephesus, doesn't all the world know that the city of Ephesus is the guardian of the temple of the great Artemis and of her image which fell from heaven? Our temple, our religion, is one of the wonders of the world. We don't need to worry about a handful of Christians. People come to Ephesus to see Artemis." I mean, look at the package tour brochures. You know, isn't hindsight a wonderful thing? Who has heard of Artemis today? Now look at the package tour brochures. By all means, you come to Ephesus, what's left of it, to follow in the footsteps of St. Paul. And as the dust settles, you see, there's only one winner. The Christian Gospels are acquitted of all charges. Verse 37, "They have neither robbed temples nor blasphemed our goddess." It's no threat to the official life of the empire. Rome need have no quarrel with the gospel. Paul will say with integrity a few chapters later, chapter 25, verse 8, "I've done nothing wrong against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar." The gospel passport is stamped for onward travel to Rome. Visa granted. It was a long, tense, frightening afternoon for those caught up in it. And a good afternoon's work. Such a good afternoon's work, Luke thought it worth recording in detail for the God who stayed backstage all the time. And as I've been thinking about it this week, trying to learn the lessons from it, it's just struck me again that Luke is writing to remind me of the confidence I can have in God, a confidence I quickly lose. Here's a passage to remind us not to go on the back foot with the gospel too quickly, not to go all defensive, not because we know opposition is out there to start apologizing for it. Now, we can't say that gospel Christianity is within every country's laws anymore, as we've seen. People write the laws to stop it. Acts doesn't even promise freedom from harm for gospel believers in every incident. But the God who sacrificed to give us a gospel, who gave his one and only Son, who allows his people to follow in Jesus' footsteps, that God will guard his gospel's purposes. I have to keep on with the gospel, even though I will get kicked in the teeth. I can't go forward with the gospel sure of any one day's outcome. That isn't the lesson of Acts 19. Or I can't go forward with the gospel only when the odds look good and in my favor. They didn't in Ephesus. But I can go forward. I must go forward with complete confidence in the God who will ensure his gospel achieves its purposes. Whether he uses his spokesmen and women or not. Whether his name comes on people's lips and gets the credit or not. Stay on the front foot. It's better to suffer for the gospel than to suffer for no gospel. Which is why our last song is a song especially worth singing tonight, isn't it? We have a gospel to proclaim, good news for all throughout the earth. Let's stand and sing.